This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Beth Voorhees at 7:33. Recently, an overflow of water from a trench at the Freedom Industries tank site in Kanawha County reached the Elk River. West Virginia's Department of Environmental Protection issued two notices of violation to Freedom for the incidents. But while the tank site is being monitored, the DEP is also beginning to focus attention on a whole bunch of other above-ground storage tanks, too. Beneduccio has more.
The DEP's new storage tank registration program is now gathering information and data from facilities across the state that meet specific guidelines. These types of facilities are expected to be in the thousands. Due to this, the DEP took an unorthodox step, asking for comments from businesses and other interested parties before they had even proposed regulations. Kelly Gillenwater is the DEP's spokeswoman.
This is a brand new program. We've never regulated above ground storage tanks. You know, and it involves a lot of new information and a lot of new data, a lot of entities that we've never really dealt with before. And because we wanted to be as transparent as possible, we started seeking public comment on the rules before we even drafted the rules.
Under new legislation, the DEP has an extensive task to first figure out what tanks are out there that hold at least 1,320 gallons of fluid, then to determine what's inside of them, and finally to determine if they would need annual inspection. The DEP is required to monitor tanks that are 90% or more above ground and in one place for more than 60 days. Gillenwater says many are already willing to play ball and have registered.
We've only been registering tanks for a couple of days, and so far there are more than 60 tanks registered, and you know, we're expecting thousands. But keep in mind, you know, that there's a lot of data that has to be inputted, and a lot of people, a lot of tank owners may not have access to our electronic submission system yet. So they are in the process of getting user IDs and passwords, and we've actually had more than 100 already login requests.
There is some industrial pushback, however. According to comments submitted to the DEP, many are concerned about meeting the October 1st registration deadline with the agency. Gillenwater says there could be consequences if tanks aren't in compliance.
Well, if a tank is out of compliance, obviously the agency will look at the mitigating factors and talk with the tank owner and try to figure out what's going on. But there is the potential for enforcement action, and that could include penalty assessments, that it could include a cease and desist order. It could include the tank actually being locked out so that it can't be used for production, and that no one, you know, that it just can't be used in the meantime until that registration or until it is back in compliance with state law or in compliance with state law.
The Division of Water and Waste Management in the DEP is leading the effort. Once the registration period is over, the DEP will determine what tanks will need additional permits. Those operators will need to pay fees to the DEP to fund this program. Evan Hansen is the president of Downstream Strategies, an environmental consulting firm.
And what we're seeing in the comment letters is not unexpected, that different industries are making the case for why their above-ground storage tanks should also be excluded. I think that the bill was written in a short amount of time, and it's certainly conceivable that there may need to be some adjustments. However, the bill is the law. I have no doubt that various interest groups will be trying to change the law during the next session.
One issue of concern to Hansen and many others, including industrial businesses, is that eventually these tanks will have to be inspected time and time again. The West Virginia DEP has struggled in the past with enforcement of inspections at many of the state's oil and gas wells. One of the main reasons was simply because it didn't have enough inspectors to do the work. Hansen says fees will hopefully solve those issues. He also points out that some of the pushback might be coming from the perception that there's already too much bureaucracy.
Many industries that have above-ground storage tanks are already operating under a number of different environmental laws. Mm-hmm. And some feel that those existing laws are sufficient, and they don't want to be subject to duplicative regulations. And so that's understandable. I don't think anybody wants to just create more red tape that's not going to actually do any good. That's not good for the West Virginia economy. It's not good for creating jobs. It's not good for anybody. But the challenge is that the legislature spoke very clearly about the minimum requirements that they need to see in the new above-ground storage tank permits. Now, if a case can be made that there's an existing regulation that applies to a tank, that's at least as stringent as Senate Bill 373, then DEP will allow that to be used instead of a new above-ground storage tank permit. But it has to be proven.
Kelly Gillenwater with the DEP says the first draft of regulations is expected to be completed within the next month. There will be an additional public comment period, and the rules will go through the legislative process next year. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Beneduccio in Morgantown.
West Virginia Superintendent of Schools James Ferris announced his retirement in April, but last week he presented his final report to the State Board of Education. In it, he recounted his accomplishments in leading the state's education system forward, but also gave a warning about what work must continue in order to truly impact student achievement. Ashton Mara reports.
At every monthly West Virginia Board of Education meeting, the state superintendent is called upon to give an update on what the Department of Education is working on and what they've accomplished since the previous meeting. June's presentation, however, was much more in-depth than usual. Instead of recounting the accomplishments of the past 30 days, James Ferris detailed the progress the department has made in the 18 months under his leadership. He addressed members of the state board.
This isn't a self-advertisement. This is an acknowledgement of the work that we have jointly done together. And I have to say that as we go through this, I think you're going to see that there is some redundancy, because many of the tasks that we had assigned could not have been done separate and apart from the Board of Education. That needed to happen. It wasn't happening in the past, at least from my perspective as a local superintendent. It seemed like there were some disjointed efforts. And so for those where it seems like these things overlap, that's an intention.
Ferris is referring to his previous job as Randolph County Superintendent. He was appointed as state superintendent in December of 2012 after Dr. Jeria Marple was fired in a surprise vote by the state board. Ferris says from his point of view at the county level, the State Department felt disjointed and as if the department and board were moving in two separate directions. That was one thing Ferris says he was able to change during his tenure. He can often be quoted as saying, "Now here's where I'm talking about this as a county superintendent," consistently bringing the local viewpoint to the discussion at the state level, whether in the boardroom or the state house. His long list of accomplishments included many legislative changes, the passage and implementation of various areas of Senate Bill 359, the Governor's Education Reform Act. Changes there included allowing counties to set their school calendar, giving teachers more of a say in hiring within their schools, and repealing 53 antiquated education statutes. The one accomplishment that sticks out to some, however, is Ferris's ability to repurpose millions of dollars in state funds from the Central Department of Education in Charleston out into the RESAs and counties, all while facing major budget cuts. Ferris maintains it wasn't finding ways to move the money that was difficult. It was convincing members of the department to get on board.
What was hard was the process of people letting go of traditional ways that they had used that money in the past. And so we had to change mindsets. Changing mindsets and letting people go of traditional things, change in general, it's always difficult.
Ferris ended his presentation with four recommendations to the eight-member board. The first, creating a consistent, cohesive message both the board and the department can deliver to schools and to the public about the future of education in the state. Second, Ferris says leadership needs to examine and review the capacity of the State Department to carry out their duties. With all of the cuts and loss in personnel, Ferris says it's possible the State Department doesn't currently have the resources to help county schools who rely on the state for guidance and assistance when they also lack resources. Next, creating an office to focus on the middle grades and making sure middle school students are prepared for more rigorous courses in high school. And finally, leaning on partnerships the department has with outside organizations to create an alternative leadership pathway, one that wouldn't require teachers to go through the higher education system to become principals or administrators in their county.
We have a perfect storm right now. We've got leaders reaching retirement age. And we need to have an influx of quality leadership in our schools if we're going to have the capacity to change and do some of the things we do. And, I was blunt. I don't think that the path we're on right now with higher education, that we're doing that.
The State Board is currently conducting their first round of interviews for applicants to take the state superintendent position. 64 applicants from across the country have applied. The board is expected to announce the finalists in the next few weeks. As for Ferris, his word of advice for his predecessor is pretty specific. He says, attend the governor's cabinet meetings, take in everything you can, and build partnerships with fellow cabinet-level secretaries. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston.
This is West Virginia Morning. It's coming up on 7:45. Mostly sunny this morning, becoming partly cloudy this afternoon with a chance of isolated thunderstorms. Temperatures ranging from the low 80s in the northern panhandle to near 90 in the southwest. Mostly clear overnight with lows in the 60s. And for tomorrow and Wednesday, mostly sunny mornings, partly cloudy with a chance of isolated thunderstorms during the afternoons. Temperatures remaining in the 80s to low 90s.
Support for West Virginia Public Radio is provided by Tamarack, the best of West Virginia in Beckley, serving the fried green tomato sandwich from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Facebook.com/TamarackWV. Support for NPR is provided by Professor Josue Harari, whose gift is in appreciation of NPR programming, its staff, and its commitment to a more informed public.
Huntington hopes an old technology proves to be the key in a new technological world. Clark Davis has the story.
Using new technology, Huntington will tap into an old form of technology, unused broadcasting frequencies. Since television stations are going digital, they have left frequencies out there available in those areas known as white space can be used to provide wireless internet access. So a group called WVNet, or West Virginia Network for Educational Telecomputing, has teamed with Huntington to provide the internet to the city free of charge for a year. Huntington Mayor Steve Williams says the technology could mean big things for the city.
What I'd like to do is create a startup community, in essence a startup village that is technologically based, and Wi-Fi of this nature, certainly by being free and we're showing that we're doing it on a cutting edge, we'll send a message that Huntington clearly is open for business.
All that's required to tap into that free white space and provide a free Wi-Fi signal through it is the use of the appropriate technology. The system will be composed of a main hub at Marshall. Antennas will be placed around the city that will pick up the broadcast signal from the hub and translate it to wireless technology that can be picked up by any piece of equipment that can pick up Wi-Fi signals. Dan O'Hanlon is director of WVNet and vice chancellor for technology at the Higher Education Policy Commission.
It'll be like you're sitting at home or sitting in a Starbucks. It's just like Wi-Fi, only it's super Wi-Fi because it covers such a broad area.
It's not a new idea for West Virginia Net to use the technology. WVNet has a system set up at West Virginia University for students to receive super Wi-Fi while they ride the personal rapid transit around campus. West Virginia Net hasn't done it for a city yet, but it won't be the first nationally either. According to a report by the Broadband Center of Excellence, Wilmington, North Carolina is the only U.S. city currently using Whitespace to create a municipal smart city wireless network.
I visited Wilmington this year and took a tour of all their facilities, looked at how they established their antenna, and I've done a partnership with the company that did it in Wilmington, and they are coming to Huntington to do it as a pilot at no cost to the city of Huntington.
O'Hanlon says they have thought about what happens if they find access points are becoming overloaded. He says they'll add more if need be later on. The coverage area will stretch in a 6-mile radius around the downtown area. He says if not used, the FCC is considering selling the white space to cellular companies. Mayor Williams says he wants the city to try to be ahead of the game. That's why he wanted to be a part of the Wi-Fi pilot program.
If you're not the lead dog, the scenery never changes. And truly, we do this in Huntington and we prove that we can do it here. Then it also sends a message to the rest of West Virginia. We don't have to be 48th, 49th, and 50th, nor should we be 19th, 20th, or 21st. We should strive to be the best.
Williams says if successful after a year, then the city will have to find ways to support and finance the system into the future. The city is also having a study done to look at the feasibility of making the area a gigabit city, meaning internet that will have speeds of up to a gigabit a second. Williams says those high internet speeds could mean the difference in keeping or attracting tech businesses.
We have some businesses that we've lost in this area, moved to North Carolina, to small towns in North Carolina, just because they weren't able to get the capacity that they needed, or if they were, it was going to cost them an arm and a leg.
The program is expected to switch on later this month or early July. Williams says they'll monitor the system to make sure that the included encryption techniques keep the Wi-Fi secure. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Clark Davis in Huntington.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Keep up with all the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Ben Aduccio. Our director is Chuck Anzalevich. I'm Beth Voorhees.